לפני שמתחילים, הודעה קצרה. אם אתם אוהבים את הפודקאסט הזה, אתם כנראה אנשים ממש מיוחדים ומרתקים. אז אם בא לכם לפגוש עוד אנשים כמותכם, וגם אותי, וגם את רלי, אנחנו עושים מפגש עוקבים שלישי. ביום חמישי, בתאריך 9 למאי 2024, בין השעות 7:30 ל-11:30, אנחנו הולכים לקיים מפגש עוקבים שלישי בבית שלי בנופים בשומרון. מה בתוכנית? מינגלין וכיבוד עם עוד עוקבים מרתקים כמוכם, הרצאה שלי, דיון לגבי הערוץ, ציור בסטודיו ובסוף קומזיץ ופיתות על הסאג'. הרשמה מראש היא חובה וניתן לעשות את זה בקישור שבתיאור הערוץ או לחפש את הלינק ביוטיוב. נשמח מאוד מאוד לראות אתכם. ועכשיו לשיחה. This is a short Hebrew introduction to my conversation with Aaron Flam, the writer of the book This is a Swedish Tiger, about the interesting connection between Sweden and the German government during World War II. If you want, you can skip right into the conversation in the timestamp below. אז מה באמת הקשר בין שוודיה ובין גרמניה הנאצית? אנחנו נוהגים לחשוב בישראל ששוודיה הייתה ניטרלית, די דומה לשוויץ, אבל האם זה באמת היה ככה? לפי המחבר של הספר, אהרון פלם, שעשה עבודה מטורפת לגבי כל הנושא הזה. אגב, כאשר קיבלתי את הספר, המכס עשה בעיות, כי אם תראו, על הנמר יש לנו בעצם פה צלב קרס, והצלב קרס עשה בעיות מאוד קשות גם במכס בישראל, אבל גם במכס בשוודיה, אוקיי? אז לפי המחבר של הספר, יש באמת בעיה, מכיוון שקודם כל שוודיה, מהתרבות שלה, מעריצה מאוד את גרמניה, ושוודיה משחקת משחק כפול. מצד אחד היא ניטרלית, אבל מהצד השני היא עוזרת מאוד לגרמניה. עד כדי כך שהכסף שגרמניה גונבת מהיהודים ועובר לבנקים בשוויץ, עובר בעצם לשוודיה, למפעלי הפלדה שלה. שוודיה מייצרת מה שנקרא את המיסבים, את הבול ברינג האלה, שמאוד מאוד מאוד עוזרים לתעשיית הנשק הגרמנית. זאת אחת הסיבות ששוודיה בעצם נהיית מעצמה של התחומים האלה אחרי מלחמת העולם השנייה, כאשר גרמניה אחרי מלחמת העולם השנייה נשארת הרוסה. המחבר של הספר, אהרון פלם, הוא סטנדאפיסט, הוא סופר, הוא באמת דמות מרתקת, ויש לו פודקאסט מאוד מאוד מצליח לקהל השמרני בשוודיה. אז חוץ מהנושאים הללו, דיברנו עוד על המון נושאים אחרים. א', למה קוראים לזה סווידיש טייגר? כי סווידיש טייגר זה בעצם הכינוי של שוודיה, כמו הבריטיש בולדוג או כמו הראשן בר, אבל מצד שני זה גם משחק מילים, כי סווידיש טייגר זה בעצם תישאר בשקט, אל תדבר יותר מדי. אז חוץ מהנושאים האלה ועל הבעיות וחוסר הרצון של שוודיה להכיל היום או להבין את את העבר שלה, כן, או את שיתוף הפעולה שלה עם הנאצים, דיברנו על מה קורה היום, והאם יש קשר בין שוודיה היום והאנטישמיות שאנחנו רואים בשוודיה לבין מה שקרה פעם. לפי אהרון פלם, העתיד של הקהילה היהודית בשוודיה הוא לוט בערפל, והוא די פסימי לגבי העניין הזה. ובעצם דיברנו על השילוב של הנושאים. אם אתה לא יודע ואתה לא מוכן להתמודד עם העבר שלך בצורה רצינית, יהיה לך בעיה קשה מאוד לתקן. דיברנו על הגירה המוסלמית, דיברנו על המנטליות השוודית, כן? מה שנקרא לגום, כל מיני רעיונות שוודים ששונים מאוד מהתרבות הישראלית, ואיך זה בעצם משפיע. כאשר יש הגירה מסיבית של אנשים מוסלמים, שבעצם לא חולקים את ה-DNA השוודי. אוקיי? אז זאת הייתה שיחה מרתקת. שלום לכולם, לי קוראים רועי יוזביץ', שבערוץ הזה אני מדבר עם האנשים החוקרים המדהימים ביותר בעולם על נושאים מגוונים כמו פילוסופיה, מדע, אומנות, אינטליגנציה מלאכותית ועוד. אם השיחה הזאת מעניינת אתכם, אתם מוזמנים להיכנס לערוץ, לראות עוד שיחות שאני עושה, אתם מוזמנים להירשם, אתם מוזמנים להיכנס לטלגרם, לבוא למפגשי עוקבים, ויש לנו עוד המון דברים מרתקים. ועכשיו, אהרון פלם. אהרון פלם, thank you so much for coming. How are you today?
I'm well, and thank you for having me.
This is your first time in Samaria?
Yes, I believe it is.
I didn't know if I want to tell you in advance, but you know, it was a nice surprise, and we know now that Samaria is very, very close to Tel Aviv.
Yeah, and I also needed to check it off my list of places to go.
Yes, so here we in Samaria, and we speak about one. This is a heavy book. This is a heavy, heavy book, as you told Dave Rubin. You want, you know, your book to hit someone, and if this book falls on your head, it is going to hurt. This is a Swedish Tiger, and this book basically is about the role Sweden has played in World War II, basically. Yes?
Not really. There's three parts to this book. The first part is about the role Sweden played in letting Islamism into Europe. And the second part is about Swedish culture from a socio-psychological perspective. And the third part is about Sweden's role in the Second World War.
Okay, so let's start. In your book, you said that every hero story begins with a call to adventure. And you began as a comedian. And you're also, and you're still a comedian, but this is a heavy tome. It's not a book. It's a heavy, heavy tome. It's a book full of research and impeccable. And what was your call to adventure when you started working on this tome?
Well, basically, as you said, I'm a stand-up comedian. I have a podcast in Sweden. On stage, I do political satire. But in the podcast, it's mainly that I started out publishing my research for my jokes. And I do a lot of research for every one-liner. So,
could you give me an example? What do you mean by research for my jokes?
Well, I want my jokes to be factually correct, but funny. And sometimes I need to delve into a subject matter so to really understand it. And I think if you do, not only does your joke become better, you also find a lot of new jokes while you're doing the research. So this is just the way I work. So I started doing political satire, sort of the research part, at least, published in my podcast. And since I'm a Jew and I made a lot of jokes about being Jewish on stage, I got a lot of questions from my listeners. And they wanted to know how I felt about Israel, what I thought about Sweden's relationship or lack thereof with Israel, and Sweden's role in the Second World War. If you take those three questions and you want to answer them properly, then you have to write a book of at least 600 pages. Actually, the outline for the book was 1,800 pages. And then my publisher said, we can't afford to send books because it will cost too much in postage. I had to cut it down to a mere 600 pages.
But one thing that I must tell about your book, that it is very funny. It's a research book, but it's very funny. Let me give you like one quote, page 185. It's very funny. The German took Norway in 2 months, the Danes in 2 days, and the Swedish with a telephone call.
Yes.
So it is full with very, very funny arguments and jokes and stories. So it is very easy to read.
Thank you. Well, it started out with I'm trying to explain the joke, a Swedish tiger. So the tiger that you can see, you can show them, there's a tiger on the front, and that's actually a parody of the original tiger. A Swedish tiger was a propaganda campaign that the Swedish government launched for the Second World War. It is equal to the British campaign, Loose Lips Sink Ships. So they wanted the Swedish populace to understand that they can't talk about everything because there might be spies around. Because the word tiger in Swedish means both the animal tiger.
And shut up.
Yeah, and shut up. So it's a double entendre. It's not a very funny joke, but... So I start by analyzing this joke and trying to explain where it comes from and what it means. And yeah.
And you were sued for using this image.
Actually, I was prosecuted by the state. I wasn't sued.
Because it was copyright and you said that it is that you use it in the law of the satire. You can use it, yes?
Yes. Well, actually, I think it was... mostly a political trial. I wrote the book. I published the book. The first two editions sold out in a month and a half. And then when I had printed the third edition of the book, police stormed the premises of my publisher and they confiscated a ton and a half of the books. And then I was prosecuted by the state for 2.5 years. And they said because of copyright infringement, parody isn't per se illegal in Sweden, so it was a
yet
sham charge. Yeah, and I won, so I won my case.
So. Okay, so with your permission, let's start in the beginning. Okay, in Israel, and today when I discuss having you here with some friends, and they say, oh, Swedish and World War II, but Swedish was neutral, like Switzerland. Okay, this is what the average Israeli knows, and also that he knows that Sweden helped in rescuing the Jews of Denmark. So, and we have like a famous song written by Nathan Alterman about how Sweden was very good to the Jewish people. So this is basically what we know. We know that in Holland we had Anne Frank, but Sweden was a neutral country. But we also know that according to the Central Bank of Sweden, between 1939 and 1944, Sweden got approximately 33 tons of pure gold from Germany.
Yes.
Okay? So basically, Sweden played in two games, just like Qatar today. She also exported and helped the German Wehrmacht, but also helped the Jews. So is Sweden neutral, like Switzerland, or is it something completely different?
It's interesting that you bring up Switzerland because they also worked with the Germans as a neutral country. And in the First World, basically, Sweden has always, for a few hundred years, Sweden was a vassal state of Germany. And it's our biggest export market. Even today, 20% of our exports is the German market. So in the First World War, Sweden was what they called actively neutral, which meant they helped the Kaiser with everything except fighting men. So if he needed medical equipment or food or even guns, they would supply them.
But in the Second World War?
No, First World War.
Okay.
So in the Second World War, we also adhered to this principle of neutrality, which meant we wouldn't partake in the fighting. And we were free to do business with both sides, but we did a lot more business with Germany, as our tradition is. And Sweden wasn't... You could think of Sweden as a non-combatant Axis power, I think, in the Second World War. So they were definitely more neutral on the German side than on the Allied side.
Okay, more neutral on the German side, which I think leads to a question that my editor, you know, pondered about. What is of Sweden with the German culture, with the German people? Okay, you said that Sweden was a vassal state for Germany, but I think there is something more. You look up to Germany in a way no other country does.
You think we do? I think the Germans look up to us in a way that no other country does. Sweden, basically...
Please elaborate.
100 years ago was considered the German highlands, basically the Scotland of Germany. So Swedes were the purest Swedes. They were the closest to their ancestral roots. This is how they view themselves. This is how Germans view them. And some Germans still have... They consider Sweden to be some sort of utopia. Now, that's changed, of course, with the large immigration we've had, but it used to be Heimat, an ideal image of what a Germanic, not German per se, but a Germanic country should be.
And Aryan, and Nordic.
Yes.
But I think that I want to distinguish between the race, okay?
Yeah.
With that, you know, they're tall, they're blonde, they're blue eyes, etc. All the stereotype of what Ari should look like, and the culture, the industry, the philosophy. Okay? So in regarding the race, regarding biology, yes, we look up to Sweden, we look up to Norway, we look up to all the Nordic people. But regarding the culture, the society, I think there is an inverse ratio between Sweden and Germany, that Sweden love the German culture, the German philosophy, the German way of thinking.
I think that's true. I think they have a lot of in common when it comes to philosophy. Germany used to have, I mean, back before the Second World War, Germany was the superpower of Europe, culturally, economically. They had a huge influence on our culture. I mean, for instance, Hegel or Marx.
Kant, Nietzsche, Heidegger, everyone just came from Germany. Physics, music, Mendelssohn, yes. Even Austria, that we know, what was his name? Stefan Zweig, you know? It's Austria versus Germany. But again, this Austria-Germany thing is the pinnacle of culture.
Yes. And I mean, apart from that, the languages are very similar. They're all Germanic languages. So it's easy for them, or should be easy for them, to understand each other. I mean, after the Second World War, Sweden had a break and happened to fall more under the American umbrella than the Russian umbrella. But it used to be under the German umbrella. And that's, I think, where it has its roots.
And due to the neutrality, Sweden is able to prosper after World War II, where Germany cannot because of the Oslo Agreement. And Sweden becomes, after World War II, the main industrial power in Europe. So if you can please elaborate on this and how this relates to the steel manufacture industry, etc.
Well, Sweden was unscathed after the Second World War. All its neighbors were bombed to smithereens, basically. But Sweden's industry was intact, and all its neighbors needed to rebuild. So Sweden had a huge advantage and was able to supply Europe with the material needed for rebuilding. And that's how Sweden became very rich.
Okay, so now, when doing this research toward this interview, there are other scholars who tackled this Sweden-Germany neutrality thing. One, for example, is Lark's landing book, Sweden Neutrality and War. So there is another aspect, but your book is very controversial.
Yes.
So what you said right now, I think, everyone who knows history knows. So what is your exact point that you say, okay...
Well, you brought up Switzerland, right?
Yes.
So the German business model was quite simple. Germany was bankrupt after the First World War, as we all know, and they needed money. So when Hitler came to power, the first thing he did was start to rob his Jews. He took their money, he took their businesses, he took everything. But he didn't have enough Jews. So after a while, he needed to invade other countries. He invaded those countries and took their gold. He went straight to their federal reserves, and he stole the gold, and then he put it in the German account in Switzerland. The Swiss, because they are great bankers, moved that gold from the German account to the Swedish account, and the Swedes supplied Germany with ball bearings. Ball bearings are small mechanical things that you need. I mean, in peacetime, you use them for bicycles and cars and everything. But in wartime, you use them for the army. No modern army can roll without ball bearings. And Sweden was, even before the war, the best manufacturer of ball bearings in the world and had 70% plus of the world market. So this was the business model. Hitler invaded other countries, stole their gold, took the gold to the Swiss. The Swiss put it in the Swedish account, and the Swedes supplied him with more weapons.
So basically, the thing that you just told me now, that the role Sweden has played in helping the Wehrmacht is something that the average Swedish child is unaware of.
Completely. Completely unaware of. I think the Swedes that survived the Second World War and lived through it, they understood that neutrality for them was a pragmatic position that allowed them to prosper and be safe. You can discuss the morality of this, and I do. I don't think it's a moral position. But afterwards, after the war, they had to refashion the myth of Swedish neutrality. So
it's like fascism, you know, that after the war, we need to say, fascism, it's basically a right-wing thing, when you know, in the region, it was a left-wing thing.
Yes, precisely. And
we need to rebuild the myth.
Yes. So they came up with this idea that Sweden was a moral superpower during the war. And they also have told all Swedish school children since, I bet, somewhere in the 50s, 60s, that neutrality is a moral position. To be neutral and not partake in fighting or war is to be good. But it's not to be good. And it's quite easy to dispel this idea, because if some, let's say a Hamas terrorist is standing in front of you, and he's got a small child with his knife against its neck, and you remain neutral to that situation, that does not make you good.
You know,
that makes you a psychopath.
There was an article about the relationship between how in Israel view the culture of Sweden, and the author said that in the cultural DNA, Sweden regard the avoiding conflict as an existential idea. This is very, very important, avoiding conflict. Okay?
Yes.
And I think that this is, again, saying that being neutral is a moral perspective. Yes. This is my moral thing. I don't want to take any side. But when, and which leads me, I think, and we will come to it in a moment, what happens when immigration takes part and you cannot be neutral anymore. Okay, but we leave it to a few minutes. So if I take like a meta perspective of your book and go from the outside, basically what we have is that Sweden has lied to itself for many, many years. And now there is like a Jewish liberal comedian that says, you should ashamed of yourself. And I think that, again, you are part of the Swedish people. You are part of the Sweden, of the Swedish culture. You were born in Sweden, yes. So how your peers are your, what were the reactions to your book, and how important for the reaction was the fact that you are Jewish?
Ah, that's a good question.
I can't prepare.
Well, I'm within the left of Sweden, which is a very big part of the Swedish populace. I'm not popular. Basically, I joke and say that they use me to scare their children to bed at night. But in certain parts, I think a lot of Swedes felt that it was a breath of fresh air. And they are as interested as I am in not living a lie. They want to live truthfully, and felt it was a good thing I did. So it depends on who you ask. If you ask the Social Democratic Party, which has built modern Sweden and has been in power for almost most of the last century, then they hate me with fervor. So does the extreme left and the environmentalists. But if you ask a more conservative or a classically liberal person, I think they say it was about time that we sort of dealt with this myth of the moral superpower, because it has done us, to be frank, a lot of harm as well. And as we sit here, Sweden has just signed the papers and joined NATO, ending 250 years of neutrality. So we are no longer required to say that neutrality is a moral position, because if that is true now, then why did we join NATO?
But just before Sweden has signed the papers, you said that the idea of moral superpower had very bad ramification, bad consequences. Could you please elaborate on this idea? Because I think it's very important. When you are raised in a way that you are being neutral, not taking any side, is a moral superpower, how can you distinguish right from wrong? Okay, so if you can elaborate on this thing.
Yes. It becomes impossible, basically, to distinguish right from wrong when you're taught that neutrality is a moral position. And this has a lot to do with socialism, I think. because socialists say they're solidaric. That's one of their main slogans. If you've seen them marching in your streets, you've heard them shout for solidarity with one thing or another. But in essence, it is an ideology that is driven by envy against people who look better, are smarter, smell better, work harder. And the only principle they care for in reality is power, to stay in power. And I don't think they believe in truth. They believe that whoever has power decides what truth is. And if you live outside of truth, then you cannot be moral.
So with your permission, let me take it to using another perspective. The idea of neutrality in a modern time Sweden is somewhat complicated because, as Claudine Gay said, we are up for free speech, okay? Mm-hmm. But you're not for free speech. If I said to a woman, you are fat, you are black, anything like this, you know, Larry Summers, the mythological president of Harvard University, was fired because he said that the aptitude of women in the STEM fields might be less than men, okay? So it's not for free speech at all.
No.
Free speech is just when concerning genocide for the Jews. And I think that the neutrality is not a sacred value in Sweden. It's a sacred value in some aspect, okay? For example, the Muslim immigration. But for other aspects, the Jewish, the state of Israel, it is another story. It's another different story.
Well, to go back to my example with the Hamas terrorist and the little girl and the knife against her throat, if you remain neutral in that position, what happens is you're giving tacit support to the terrorist because you're not intervening in this situation. And that makes you a bad person, basically. And if you have to justify this for yourself, well, the only way is to say, well, this was the right thing to do, and when it's clearly the wrong thing to do. So you're starting to mix up right and wrong quite immediately. Take, for instance, the Second World War. Sweden was neutral in the face of enormous evil, right? Germany Yes. was enormous evil, Definitely. Without a doubt.
Definitely.
So, and they attacked all their neighbors. And in the beginning of the war, it was quite unclear that the Allies, England was by itself. It was not clear that England would prevail. And then Germany would have taken all of Europe. And Sweden would have been one of the countries that didn't protest against this enormous evil.
Okay.
So if you don't protest against evil, if you don't take a stand against evil, then evil will prevail. And then what does that make you? And how do you justify it to yourself? If you try to justify it, the only way is to say, well, I am neutral, it's the highest value, and then evil wins, and then what? I mean, it makes you unable to distinguish right from wrong.
So let me give you a concrete Swedish example. You know, there was the right-wing party that used to be a pro-Nazi, but now it's very pro-Israel. And, you know, in the mainstream media, no one votes for the right-wing party, but we know that most policemen vote for the right-wing party because they know that most violence occurs within Muslim communities, and they see it and they feel it and they get in touch with it on a daily basis. So this is why the right-wing party that is against the Muslim violence has many voters within the policemen in Sweden. Up until now, is this correct? What you just said?
You can't really find out who votes for whom in Sweden. We have secrecy of elections, but they are the second biggest party in parliament at the moment. So the Swedish Democrats, that's the party you're talking about. And since they're the second biggest party, I bet a lot of people are voting for them, not only police, but former leftists have abandoned the left.
So why can't we say in mainstream media, there is a Muslim violence, okay? And say, and no, there is some violence like in France. There, we hate the extremists of both sides. No, there is only one side of one major side, okay? And we are neutral regarding the Muslim immigration in Sweden, but we are not neutral at all towards the state of Israel. So how come, how do the Swedish distinguish between the two in their mind?
That's a very hard question. I don't know if I can answer that truthfully, but I'll give it a try. Swedes, I think, have always had a sort of hard time for Jews. And I think it has a lot to do with most Jews, at least back then intellectually, they were not conformist. So they're not conflict avoidant, which creates tensions. And if you wanted to be a Jew in Sweden, basically for most of the last century, you kept your head down and you didn't take up too much space. And now it's like that again.
You know, it seems that the Jews, they had a silent agreement with Europe. You will give up your Jewish identity. Don't dress like a Jew, don't speak like a Jew, nothing. Just be like us, the idea of emancipation, okay? And we will receive you, we will receive you. It's like Pichte said, I think we need to take all the Jewish in Germany and cut their head and replace it with a German head, okay? Just take, I don't want any Jewish feature. And if you lose everything that you have, I will accept you as a Swedish. And most Jews did it in Europe, in Germany, of course. But the Europeans, the Germans and the Swedish didn't accept them. And they, wow, but we did exactly what you said that we need to do. Stefan Zweig, just before he commits suicide, said, I don't understand. The Jews were being persecuted for hundreds of years. But in the Middle Ages, they knew why they are being after, because of their religion. But now Jews, they don't know why. You lost everything to be part of the Swedish or European culture, but the other side didn't fulfill the agreement.
Well, I was raised not to tell people I'm Jewish. My grandparents told me it was a dumb idea. And I thought they were dumb and old. And when I started doing stand-up, I made a lot of jokes. And I still do a lot of jokes about me being Jewish. And these days, when you see marches on the streets of Stockholm calling for global intifada or there is only one solution, intifada revolution, you know, they have very catchy rhyming slogans. I'm thinking they might have been right. But as you can tell, I'm not donning the kippah. I don't have the tzitzis. You can't tell that I'm Jewish. Well, in the Swedish context, you can, at least before I got gray hair.
You have a lovely nose.
Okay, thank
you. Not like me, that I have like a very Jewish style.
You want to switch? So, I think there's a point to what you're saying. And Stefan Zweig was probably quite shocked because the Jews of Germany, they were really assimilated at the time Hitler rose to power, most of them. But it's also...
They couldn't be assimilated more. This is the idea. Being a German Jew and being German were basically the same thing. You know, there is a very famous story that the Minister of Education of Nazis, the Nazi Minister of Education, once opposed David Hilbert, the famous mathematician, in Göttingen University, and asked him, what about the math situation in Germany now that we expelled all the Jews from the math department? And David Hilbert said, there is no math in Germany anymore. Okay? The idea is that being a German Jew, being a German, is like the pinnacle of culture. Okay? And you know, Lorelei, you know, it is a pinnacle of poetry by Heinrich Heine, which was also a Jew.
Yes, he was. Although he converted to Lutheranism. So
again, we don't know anything about a very strong Jewish community in Sweden.
Well,
Not like Poland, not like Germany, not like, you know, other places where the Jewish took a very impressive role in the country.
Well, I think a lot of Swedish Jews have been quite successful in integrating and contributing to Swedish culture through the years. While
having the Jewish identity? Or?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, they weren't ultra-Orthodox, but I grew up semi-conservatively Jewish, the Jewish congregation of Stockholm. You know, we have synagogues and we celebrate the high holidays and we have a Jewish school and we have a summer camp and so on and so forth. But the Jews of Sweden is a very, very small minority today, between 12 and 16,000, and it's dwindling because of the immigrant situation.
And as a kid, you didn't experience any anti-Semitic violence.
That's not exactly true.
Not any. Okay.
It happened.
Okay.
I mean, when I grew up in the 90s, Sweden had a skinhead culture.
Okay.
And there was a resurgence of some sort of national pride, I think. The political class worked very hard to get rid of them and admitted a lot of immigrants. It happened once in my life that I was beat up, and possibly because I'm Jewish.
Because you are very annoying as a stand-up comedian.
that might have played a part. But
Israeli doesn't always lose in the Eurovision contest because anti-Semitism. Sometimes the song is just bad, okay?
Yes, quite. But I'm sure you've heard of Malmö. No?
No.
Malmö is the southernmost city of Sweden. It used to have, in Swedish terms, a large Jewish congregation, 5,000 people. It's now 300. Swedish Jews are leaving Malmö. Some are moving here. Some are moving to Stockholm. In Gothenburg, the Jews are quite afraid. That community is dwindling as well. And we'll see how long the Stockholm congregation lasts.
And what about violence incidents against Jews from the Muslim community?
Well, there are threats, there has to be police outside of the school, the Jewish school. And recently there was someone threw a hand grenade into the yard of the Israeli embassy. And there are marches in Stockholm since October 7th. There is marches every weekend, basically.
If someone invites me to do a lecture in Sweden, will you advise me to wear a yarmulke on the street? Or you say, I think it's not wise nowadays?
Well, if you ask me, I think you should wear your yarmulke in the streets, your kippah, if you want to. Just stick to the right parts of town. But if you ask the police or politicians, they would say, no, hide your kippah, hide your Star of David. Don't let anyone know you're Jewish.
But they will know eventually, because it is not about how you look. It's about something much more profound. It's about the philosophy. It's about how we differ from Christianity, how we differ from secular values. Israel and the Jewish state of Israel and Judaism is not another country in the 50, it's not the 54th country in the US. There is a very good reason why there is Jerusalem on one side and Athens or Rome on the other side. We can, you know, learn from each other and we can appreciate each other. but we are not Western civilization. We are something else. We can learn, we can appreciate, we can, but we also contribute. And I think that what Judaism contributes is something profoundly different from Western civilization. And I can just tell you one thing. According to Western philosophy, according to Greek philosophy, we say that the good is also beautiful, okay? There are two very, very similar things. According to Judaism, they think there are two independent things. One thing can be very good, morally good, but not beautiful, okay? The ethics and the aesthetics are completely different in Judaism. But this is just my...
Obviously, because I would say that Judaism is part and parcel of Western civilization. I think it's part of the cradle that Western civilization sprung from.
Definitely,
Together with Greek philosophy and
okay, definitely, Rome. Definitely. But would you say...
that, I mean, no Judaism, no Christianity.
No. Yes, but you said... I will argue that although we can discuss Judeo-Christian ideas, we have Judeo ideas and Christian ideas, which are very different.
Yes,
okay?
They are.
Judaism and Christianity are not the same thing, okay?
Not according to my experience.
Okay.
No.
And one can say, okay, and I think that my idea in my job in this podcast, the idea or the question that I ask is, do I think that Judaism has something unique and important and relevant to say, to contribute to the table of ideas of the 21st century?
Let's hope so.
And I surely believe that there is. But if there is, you need to sit at the table and you need to listen to all the other participants in the table. Okay? You need to take from them, but you also need to say, okay, this is my philosophy. This is my gift to humanity that I bring to the table. And I think that this gift, this set of ideas, are still relevant in the 25th century, not just 3,000 years ago, okay? What we believe, I think, what Judaism has to offer to the world right now is very relevant, especially to secular society like Sweden or like Europe in general. Okay, so...
I would say there is no secular society without Judaism and Christianity. I mean, it comes from Christianity, mainly.
Yes, definitely. But there is no secular Muslim society, okay? And you're absolutely right about it. Charlie Hebdo, okay? This is you can't make laugh of Muhammad, okay?
I've read the Quran.
Yeah, even...
Quite, there's a surah about it.
You can, but there are very bad consequences. But you can make fun of God, of the Jewish God, okay? There is like there was an article in Ynet recently. Someone asked ChatGPT, please tell me a Jewish joke. And ChatGPT told a Jewish joke, and then it said, please tell me a Muslim joke. Said, no, I can't do it, okay? So Jewish joke, you can do it with ChatGPT, but Muslim joke, no, you can't do Muslim jokes, okay?
But of course, I mean... In the Old Testament, when Abraham asks God, so what do you want for, you know, the land and the fact that I will be a father of many nations and that many of my children and grandchildren become kings and queens. And God says, well, I want that little piece of skin at the end of your penis. Then Abraham falls on the floor laughing.
And don't eat the shrimp, okay? I will tell you why later on. Okay, now, there is one word in Swedish, you know, or it's an English word, but you Swedish interpret it very differently. Individualism, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if all Swedish people say, we are individualist, okay? It's like the story of Brian. We are all different, okay? Basically, how the average Swedish person interprets the world in individualism?
Well, we don't really have individualism. We have something called state individualism, which means that the state will provide every citizen with an equal amount of individualism that is exactly the same as everybody else's individualism. So, You've probably heard the expression, two Jews, three opinions.
Yeah.
Well, in Sweden, we have another expression that I've actually coined, which is 8 million Swedes, one opinion.
Okay.
So that's, Sweden is a conformist country. And I think what happened to individualism in Sweden, because we have state individualism, is that Swedes equate individualism more with what I would call atomism. Because what happened was that Swedish individualism attempted to free the individual from obligation, which means obligation to your family, to your friends, to society. And instead of freeing the individual, they made the individual dependent on the state, which isolated them from their family and their friends and their neighbors, okay. Hence atomism.
So basically, you know, the state as a living organism is a hyper-collectivist idea. Rudolf, how you spell it? Jelen?
Schellian.
Schellian, thank you so much. Rudolf Schellian was not to know that his theory would bridge the gap between ancient Eastern legacies that still lurked behind the contract-based rule of law, which was the actual reason for the construction and the emergence of the rule of law, and the as yet still non-existent national socialist ideology. Okay?
Yes. Well, Rudolf Schellian was a famous political scientist, probably the most famous political scientist that Sweden has ever had, one of the most famous in the world when he was alive. He coined the phrase geopolitics. That comes from Rudolf Schellian. And Rudolf Schellian used to believe in the a society based on rule of law. But then he developed a new theory about organic states. And what happened was that he wanted to get rid of the rule of law. He thought it was nonsensical and it should be based more on culture. And I think this part of his philosophy is what inspired the National Socialists of Germany, among them Hitler.
Okay, so there is a term that I asked you before, a Swedish term, that the Israeli journalist that lived in Sweden for 3 years was first told that the most important word in Sweden for immigrants is logum.
Lagom.
Lagom, which basically can be translated to blend in.
Yeah.
Okay, please give me the correct translation.
There's no real translation, okay. But lagom means not too much, not too little. Yes. Just the right amount. So if someone asks, someone is treating you to dinner, they've cooked a nice dinner for you, and they ask you, how much do you want on your plate? And you say, lagom. Not too much, not too little. And this applies to everything, style of clothing. And it has to do with
IKEA is not too much, is not too little, it's not very expensive, it's like the
it's logom.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. But again, the logom is not just in the style of dressing, and it's not just in what you have on your plate, it's what you have on your mind.
Okay? Yes.
What we have, it's like you can't be an entrepreneur with a logom set of mind. Or with logom philosophy. And this is why that you need, or in Swedish school, they teach, you know, they try to teach entrepreneurship, but again, it's unnatural. It's not natural. It doesn't stick. Because if the state of mind is not too much, not too little, how can you be an entrepreneur?
Well, we have a lot of entrepreneurs in Sweden, but I think you're right. Those people have not had logom mindset. A dear friend of mine called Henrik Jönsson, he's a famous YouTuber in Sweden, he's an entrepreneur. He definitely does not have a logom mindset, and he doesn't dress in a logom way. He dresses very extravagantly. So
you have exceptions, okay.
But I think logom has to do with something that is pervasive all over Scandinavia, which is called the law of Jante, which is a set of commandments, basically, to promote conformism and collectivism. And this leads to passive aggressiveness. And it is a sort of a shackle of the mind.
Why do you think that it leads to being passive aggressive?
Because conformism is about adapting to the group. And in order to adapt to the group, you can't be confrontational. And if you can't be confrontational, you will still have problems with people around you. And hence, you have to be passively aggressive and not aggressively aggressive.
So you chose a very bad profession in Sweden. You know, you're a stand-up comedian, you're a jester. As being a stand-up comedian, your job is precisely to be confrontational, you know, to take the truth and take it. Oh, you are all one-minded. You need to be the mirror.
Well, to paraphrase my British colleague, Jimmy Carr, doing comedy in Sweden is, how do you say it? It's missionary work.
You know, there is a friend and a colleague of mine, Professor Gad Yair, wrote a book about Germany after World War II. And he said, you know, that Germany, Israeli sees the German culture and German people in a very bizarre and interesting way, because the German distinguish between nudity and sex, which we Israeli do not. Okay, nudity means sex. Okay, yes. in Israel. And what Professor Gad Yair tried to say in his book, that after World War II, the German authorities or the German culture try to discipline men to be less masculine. Okay, this is why men urine sitting, not standing, in Germany. Okay? And this is part of the trauma of the World War II. I don't want over-masculinity with the German men. And is it possible that part of not too much, not too many, is part of the being neutral thing that happened after World War II?
So, well, Sweden also has a thing for nudity, not as much anymore, but in the 50s and 60s and 70s, 60s and 70s, absolutely. And I think one separates it from sex. It has to do with a love for nature and how it's considered to be natural to be naked. And I mean, it's a very cold country, so you can't be naked all year round. But in the summertime, if you want to connect to nature, there's nothing more natural than skinny dipping. Do you understand
that? Yes.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And then laying on a cliff and letting the sun dry your naked body.
Okay, but it's not what I ask. I ask about the philosophy of lagoon. Maybe the philosophy of lagoon is part of the philosophy of being neutral. Not too much, not too many, I don't want. Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe there's a connection. Neutrality, I think, has more to do with cowardice.
Okay. Now, according to the Swedish Social Security from 2017, approximately half of 100,000 workers illness vacation suffered from, how do you say it?
Utmattningssyndrom.
Utmattningssyndrom, which is being tired of life, basically. Okay?
Yes.
And again, this journalist said that this is a very acutic problem in Sweden. So many young people suffer from tiredness of life, and they feel that there is too much stress in Sweden, not in Israel, you know, where they're bombing all the way, all day long. In Sweden, they feel too much stress from life. Now, how do you explain this?
I think it has to do a lot with our welfare state, that everyone is supposedly taken care of, makes people
irresponsible for themselves.
Well, partly, but also it protects them from life's reality, which is problems. Life is full of problems. And if the state is supposed to take care of all your problems, then you become very, very bad at handling them. So here, where you have real problems with bombs being dropped on your heads, you don't have time to become tired of life, as you would call it.
In New Zealand, the suicidal rate is very high because nothing bad happened there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is mostly the case with the Swedes as well. We have also a very high suicide rate. But that's partly, you know, the welfare state, but partly also the darkness.
Okay, so again, if the state takes over of your problems, you're becoming very bad handling your problems. I think
yes.
This is a very important message Now, three years ago, there was a very important satir sketch by Eretz Nehderet.
I know Eretz Nehderet.
And the satir sketch basically called for a civil war. You know, the war after election, and they say election is a party for democracy. And the guy in the sketch said, we are too diverse. We have the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox and the secular. We are too diverse. We need a civil war. We need a civil war in Israel. And then he said, look at Sweden. They have a tall Swedish. They have a tall Sweden. They have a short Sweden, fat Sweden, thin Sweden. But they're all Sweden. We need to be like Sweden. They just have one type, Sweden. And this is how we as Israel perceive Sweden. And I think which boils down to the idea of diversity. Okay? Now, what you said right now, that how this, are we wrong considering, you know, Sweden as being a very non-diverse country?
I think you are. And I think a lot of Swedes still think of Sweden as one of the most homogeneous countries in the world, both ethnically and culturally. But we've let in a lot of immigrants since the 70s and from the 90s on an enormous amount. So Sweden today is a heterogeneous country. It's just that the political establishment hasn't really caught on to it yet. All the policies and the culture is still based on the idea of the ethnically and culturally homogeneous Swede. But we are not. Now we have plenty of immigrants from all over the world, a lot from the Muslim world, but also from other parts of the world. And I think 30% of the Swedish population by now is not ethnically Swedish and have their, you know, own culture from their country of origin that, you know, comes with the territory, so to speak.
And maybe I can say that just like the American Constitution can be built just on the foundations of the Old Testament or just believe in God, okay, maybe the concept of the Swedish welfare state can be relevant or can work only if all the citizens have this Swedish moral of work, okay? And if we import people that have a very different work ethics, okay? They don't consider themselves part of this one lovely nation that we all work for the nation. The nation is a big family. It's all going to collapse sooner or later.
Well, I think the idea of the welfare state was based on the population working. 85% of the population has to be working full time in order for it to work.
And want to work. Yes. Don't want to fool and trick the country.
No. They really want. And taking subsidies back when they constructed the welfare state was considered shameful. It was a last resort.
Yes.
But then in Sweden, we have this saying where it takes one generation to acquire the wealth, one generation to manage the wealth, and one generation to
destroy
the wealth. Okay. And I think we're in the maybe third generation of wealth destroyers by now, because you become accustomed to the system, you know. In the beginning, the system is there just for those who need it, but after a while, everyone's on subsidies because you get subsidies for children, for instance. Mm. Every child gets a subsidy, and after a while...
Carrot and stick, you don't have a real motivation to work. And again, If your neighbors exploit the system in such a bad way, there was like a joke that the journalist said that there was an Iranian immigrant, okay, that came to a shoe store with torn shoes after 3 years and said, I want to replace, I want a 70%
rebate
because the shoes are torn after 3 years. And she told me, no, but after 3 years, we can only give you 40%. I said, okay, can we settle on 60%? Okay, so you can't tweak the system in such a way. So do you think that...
Because what happens then is that your neighbors see you tricking the system, and then they think, I might as well start tricking the system, because otherwise that's unfair, and then everybody starts tricking the system.
I'm an Israeli, I totally understand.
And then the system won't work anymore.
So again... Would you say that the majority of the Swedish people now understand this idea that the welfare state, given immigrants from other society, other cultures that don't want really to blend in with the Swedish work ethics, we need to change something profoundly in our way of thinking?
I think they want change. I don't think they understand what type of change they need. I don't think they understand that the immigrants didn't invite themselves. They were invited by Sweden. So it's not the immigrants' fault. It's the fault of the system, basically, and how that system makes people think. Because in the Swedish mind, all the citizens are, or I mean, it used to be this way, in the social democratic mind, it still is, all citizens are perfectly replaceable. I mean, I can do your job, you can do my job, it's just citizens, and they are all the same. But people are not the same. Swedes were not the same before the immigrants came either, but they were conformist, and it sort of worked for a while. Now it won't work, because people won't adapt, especially some type of immigrants won't adapt to this.
So I don't know what to ask you next. Are you optimistic or pessimistic, or what are your what is your forecast for, you know, the next 10 years in Sweden?
Well, I think Al-Swed will be a beautiful country if you're a Muslim. I'm quite pessimistic about Europe in general and the West. It seems to have lost the plot completely. They don't, they're not able anymore to tell enemy from friend, which I think is quite obvious when you see how they treat Israel. And if you don't know who's your enemy and who's your friend, if you can't tell right from wrong, then your society is doomed.
I think that which, you know, Gibbon, the decline and collapse of the Roman Empire, said the very same thing, that that an empire collapses not because of an external war. An empire collapses because it lost faith in its own values.
Yes, and okay? Subsidies. And they gave huge subsidies to their citizens, yes. And after a while, they couldn't afford it anymore.
And I would even argue that some of the values of Europe were Christianity, or again, even God. And if you omit God from the equation and you stick only with rational thinking, you can lead to, I don't know, the concentration camp, basically. Or the idea of the Enlightenment, that the rational thinking alone will save humanity, I think proved wrong completely. And we need to.
I would settle
think
for truth.
Different. Okay.
I would settle for truth. If truth was still an idea, I think
a value.
A value, exactly, that people believed in. I mean, you can substitute it with God if you want to, but truth is enough. And we live in a postmodern society. They don't believe in truth anymore.
You're always welcome in Israel.
Thank you. I might have to move here. Yeah. I mean, from necessity, if nothing else.
Yes. Aaron Flam, thank you so much for this wonderful and quite pessimistic conversation.
Thank you for having me, Roy.
אם הגעתם עד לכאן, מגיע לכם כל הכבוד. אז תנו לי להגיד לכם שלושה דברים קצרים. הדבר הראשון, אם שמעתם משהו בשיחה שמעניין אתכם, שאתם רוצים לקחת הלאה, פשוט ספרו אותו לאנשים אחרים. משהו מעניין שאני אמרתי, משהו מעניין שהאורח שלי אמר, איזשהו רעיון שאתם רוצים לקחת אתכם לחיים, פשוט ספרו אותו לחבר או לחברה. זאת הדרך הטובה ביותר לזכור את הרעיונות מתוך השיחות האלה. הדבר השני, אם אתם רוצים לקחת חלק בקהילה שלנו ולפגוש ולדבר עם אנשים כמוכם, אתם מוזמנים לערוץ הטלגרם שלנו, שווה לכם מאוד. פשוט תראו עוד אנשים שמתעניינים מדברים מגניבים בדיוק כמוכם. והדבר האחרון, אם אתם יכולים, דרגו את הערוץ שלנו באפליקציית הפודקאסטים שלכם, זה יכול להיות בספוטיפיי, באפל פודקאסט או בגוגל פודקאסט, זה תהליך קצר של שתי שניות, הוא מאוד מאוד יעזור לנו להפיץ את הבשורה הלאה. שיהיה לכם כיף גדול, וכיף בשיחה הבאה.